I can go no further.
Get on your knees.
Without fear in the face of your enemies. Be brave and upright that God may love thee. Speak the truth always, even if it leads to your death. Safeguard the helpless and do no wrong. That is your oath. And that's so you remember it.
Rise, knight. I'm Baron of Evelyn. God, not your son. Are you sorry for all your sins?
For all but one.
The haystack sat down with his yawning. Yes, he has been calling you. And he will have to do his guard and spirit of safety.
Your quality will be known among your enemies before ever you meet them, my friend.
You were not that man's servant.
No. He was my servant.
What becomes of us?
As you deserve. You reap what you sow. You have heard of this, no? Get up. You may go into Kerak, but you will die there. My master is here.
Tell my lord Salahdin, Jerusalem has come.
حاضروا هنا.
I pray you pull back your cavalry and leave this matter to me.
I pray you retire unharmed to Damascus. Reynald of Châtillon will be punished. I swear it. Withdraw, we will all die here. Do we have terms?
We have terms. I will send you my physicians.
Salam alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
In France, Master Gravedigger.
My lord!
They will ask for terms. They must ask for terms.
Convert to Islam. Repent later.
You've told me a lot about religion, Your Eminence.
Will you yield the city?
Before I lose it, I will burn it to the ground. Your holy places, ours, every last thing in Jerusalem that drives men mad.
I wonder if it would not be better if you did. You will destroy it?
Every stone and every Christian knight you kill will take 10 Saracens with him. You will destroy your army here and never raise another. I swear to God that to take this city will be the end of you.
Your city is full of women and children. If my army will die, so will your city.
You offer terms, I ask none.
I will give every soul safe conduct to Christian lands. Every soul. The women, the children, the old, and all your knights and soldiers, and your queen. Your king, such as he is, I leave to you and what God will make of him. No one will be harmed, I swear to God.
Christians butchered every Muslim within the walls when they took this city.
I am not those men. I am Salah ad-Din.
Salah al-Din.
Then under these terms, I surrender Jerusalem.
Assalamu alaikum.
And peace be with you. What is Jerusalem worth?
Nothing. Everything.
All right. Before we get started, let's begin with a word from our friends at Benson Honey Farms.
Okay. We're going to talk about first principles tonight during our Kingdom of Heaven discussion. I know Chris loves first principles discussions. And the first principle of food might as well be honey. It's nature's ultimate elixir. It's an antioxidant, antifungal, helps you sleep. It's a cough suppressant, all the things you see right here. Immunity booster. It also never goes bad. I don't know how many other things in nature never go bad that you can eat and that are delicious like this, but honey's one of them. Kind of feels like a cheat code to me. Feels like it should be a fake thing. Shouldn't even really exist. And the little bugs make it, but it's pretty crazy. If you want some of this goodness from Nebraska, go to badlandsmedia.tv/honey. And tell them we sent you, put it on everything, and put it in your soap as well. You can rustle your jimmies and then wash them afterwards. Badlandsmedia.tv/honey.
That was really something.
Yeah. I almost got through that one more. Yeah, I almost got through that one a little bit more serious, and then just my inner self took over.
I think you did a great job. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Welcome to Badlands Story Hour. I am Chris Paul. That is Burning Bright. We are discussing tonight Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven, and more particularly the director's cut, which I'm told makes all the difference in the world. And Burning Bright is going to tell us all about that.
Yeah, I'm pleasantly surprised to see that in chat, Bay Theater Dave, many others were talking about this as well. I told Chris before the stream, you know, that it can sound like a hipster thing when you're a movie guy and you're telling your friends, like, watch the director's cut. I do it with Lord of the Rings. But I will admit that while I think the Lord of the Rings director's cuts enhance the movie, you do not need to see them to experience the story of Lord of the Rings. They just flesh out little character beats. The director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven, 2005, from Ridley Scott, is a different movie than the theatrical version. It's about 55 minutes longer than the theatrical cut. About 25 minutes of that is literally the opening of the movie. Mm-hmm. So if you imagine Fellowship of the Ring with no Shire and everybody just starts off in a group together, you've no wonder when people saw this movie, including me, I was like, yeah, great production value. It looks fantastic, but it shows you that if you do not have a connection to the human element of what is going on, so much else is lost. And anyway, the director's cut, this is, I can honestly say after rewatching it, I'd also said to Chris before the stream, sometimes we revisit some of our old movies we like with awakened eyes or awakening eyes, and we are disappointed or upset. I like this movie even more than I thought I did. I can say it's probably one of my favorite movies. Bay Theater Dave in the chat said, better than Gladiator. I agree with that. It is a little blasphemous to say. I think this is Ridley Scott's best movie, personally. And I think there's a lot going on here. And I also think, you know, maybe something we can get into a little bit here after your opening thoughts is, are there any maybe nefarious reasons we could look to why the theatrical version was the way it was, given the time period in which it came out? Because I have a couple ideas on that. But this was the first time you had seen the movie, right?
Yeah. So I haven't seen the theatrical version, and I probably didn't see it because I heard it was bad. And I figured, okay, Orlando Bloom doesn't really quite get there as a leading man. I had already, that was already an opinion that I had. And when I heard the movie wasn't good, I was like, okay, I don't need to see one of these kind of epic Knights and Castles movie, despite how much I love Knights and Castles. Since I was a kid, I've thought that that was the coolest thing that ever existed. And I still, am obsessed with castles. Anytime I travel to some place that might have them, I want to go see the castle and be in the castle. I think it's like the coolest stuff. I was overwhelmed by this movie. I found it really impressive. I can't imagine watching this movie in a dumbed down theatrical version that doesn't take the time with the characters and doesn't take the time with some of the faith aspects in terms of the, what is her name? Sybilla? Her role. I, if I understand correctly, her son is not a major part or any part of the theatrical version. So
he's almost not even in it. Yeah.
Yeah. So her motivations, I guess at that point, would become entirely unclear and even more sociopathic than they are in this version, which would then make her less redeemable, making their coming back together at the end seem more implausible. So, yeah, I mean, seeing it this way, I can't imagine it in a more kind of action-oriented, more fast-paced version. That doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, and I guess I'll, you know, just it's worth people knowing. If you did watch the theatrical edition, you'll probably still get something out of the discussion, but I implore you to seek out the director's cut. You mentioned Sybilla there. That's a good point. One of the big criticisms of the theatrical version of this movie was the fact that there was a schmaltzy Hollywood romance crammed into the third act of the movie because there was no lead up, there was no motivation, there was no genuine connection between these characters. You didn't really get the backstory between her and Gilda Lee. I don't know how to pronounce it, but
Guy de I can't remember what it is. I'll figure it out. Go ahead.
Guy de Lusignan. I'm sure I pronounced that perfectly. But you barely get any of that. As I said, the biggest gap in the theatrical edition is that you basically get none of Balian, played by Orlando Bloom's, backstory. You know that his wife died and he lost a child. You basically know nothing else. You don't know any connections. You don't know that he kills his brother at the beginning there. I mean, there's a lot to it. The motivations of Liam Neeson, his father, are really not in the theatrical edition. And then if I want to look at Nefarious, the story of why this was chopped up, the month of release, is that Fox wanted Scott to produce a more action-oriented, fast-paced movie. And maybe I can buy that. The thing is, I notice that some of the things throughout the movie that are pulled out of the theatrical edition is the portrayal and philosophies of the Christians played by Liam Neeson, Jeremy Irons, who's also fantastic in this in a limited role, and you mentioned his name, David Thewlis, the hospitaler, you know, the sort of religious cleric of the group. Most of his scenes are not in the theatrical edition. And what my opinion is of what was going on here, remember, this was 2005. This was in the go get those bastards era still of American, the American zeitgeist. Wow. And there was some backlash to it. But I started to think, I remember when I saw this, and I was in a liberal mindset when I saw this movie, I was going like, yeah, I didn't really like the movie, but I liked the message. And to me, the message was the Muslims are the good guys, and we're over there invading them, and the Christians and the Crusaders are bad. And it's because the theatrical edition gives a lot of play to the Templars, Brendan Gleeson, all of that storyline. They give almost no play to the other Christians played by Jeremy Irons and the guys I just mentioned. And I think what Hollywood was doing there, the studios, is they were saying, we're going to do the controlled opposition dynamic here. We're going to do the Muslims are actually the good guys. We're going to play to the liberal audience. And we're going to paint the Christians. We're going to start this backlash or accelerate this American backlash against Christendom, which worked on me. Whereas, in my opinion, when you see the full version, I think it's a beautiful representation of the extremes on both sides, and then the men of God who are trying to navigate those extremes in between. Even the ones such as Jeremy Irons and, like I said, David Thewlis, who I think do a great job of hinting that they have been crusaders in the past and that they have found God, true God, which is a search for peace and defense of the innocent. But I'll pass it off to you. But if that's a conspiracy theory, I could see that being one of the reasons they wanted some of that nuance gone.
Yeah, I could absolutely understand that. And I mean, the timing of it is obviously crucial in that regard. I read through a week or two ago, Rich Higgins' book, The Memo, where he kind of gives his background and explains what led him to write The Memo. And a whole section of the book was about how in that era in Washington, D.C., and in the military establishment, it was basically the rule that you could not have that conversation about Islam. It could only be referred to as a religion of peace. And that was just going to be how they all approached it, because anything else was going to open the whole situation up to suspicion, essentially. They had to work against America's best interests, and that was coming down from the top. So I can imagine that sort of thing would absolutely infect Hollywood and their decision making about a movie like this, because this kind of says this is an historic thing that has been going on for 1,000 years. This isn't they hate us for our freedom. This isn't some tiny pocket of people. There's a larger conflict. And the context of that conflict was removed from the official story within the central narrative that we had been told about 9/11 and what was happening over in Iraq and what was happening over in Afghanistan. Now, I don't believe when that story is finally all told, as people will understand it in a history where we win and not these global communists, I don't believe that people will see that as a religious conflict. They will see that as, in a large degree, a false flag operation designed to accomplish a whole lot of political agenda items that couldn't have otherwise been pushed through, most specifically the Patriot Act, but a range of other desires and needs were taken care of at that point, including, by the way, covering up Pentagon malfeasance and spending. Yeah. So I could totally see Hollywood wanting to nip that in the bud before that conversation ever gets started. And so when you do that and you take the heart out of the movie and try to sell it as a big Hollywood blockbuster, and it's not a good or successful one of those without the story there, you've effectively made it so that no one actually watches that film and engages with those ideas, because in the director's cut, at least, the presentation is somewhat secular. Like, you have to just understand that the multiculturalism is part of secularism. It's part of that global agenda, but it's not pushed to the fore, and it's not completely done at the expense of a positive and faithful representation of some of the Christian beliefs that speak to people's better nature.
Right. Yeah, you know, we've talked about this in the past, but part of that controlled opposition dynamic, it goes and it can be applied. It's a framework or a template that can be applied to so many different things, right? It can be applied to nations on an absolute macro. It can be applied to just specific leaders, specific deployments and stories. But that era, 2005 era, I think it was really successfully by the establishment narrative setters being played on the American people. Eventually, I'd like to write a book, The Patriot Pendulum, partly about my mental journey as a former liberal and realizing in hindsight that while I was accurately at the time recognizing the evils that the government and the West was perpetrating on the East, I was then that recognition was being weaponized by the cultural power base of the U.S., meaning Hollywood. And Hollywood and the government were basically the controlled opposition dynamic that, of course, at the time I had no mental framework for that. But in hindsight, I really think that's what was going on, is that Hollywood was getting ahead of the pendulum shift, and they were setting narratives to say, to pick up on the growing frustration and cynicism within the American populace about the wars in the Middle East under the Bush administration. And then Hollywood had Obama waiting in the wings in 2008 to come in and say, see, we've been telling you, the culture has been prepping you that the Muslims are the good guys and we're the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And we need to basically have an era of Obama of repentance for all of this stuff that we're doing, when really Hollywood has always been just there. They were just prepping you for the second iteration of that establishment. And one through line in this movie that I think nails that, or nails that in a bad way in the original theatrical edition, that I think is fleshed out in the director's cut, is Orlando Bloom's Balian himself. There's a note of cynicism to him, especially when it comes to matters of faith. He starts the movie burying his wife, who dies of suicide after they lose their child. He's got some lines throughout the movie, including at the end, where he tells the priest, you've taught me a lot about religion. And at the time, that really spoke to me, kind of being atheistic and being like, look at what religion is being used to do. Whereas that is still there in the director's cut, but I think it's very nicely balanced by characters such as his father, played by Liam Neeson. David Thewlis has a fantastic scene where Orlando Bloom's character, Balian, basically tries to be a modern debunker when he throws rocks at the burning bush, and then the other bush catches on fire, and Thewlis tells him, like, he says, see, look, there's your Moses right there. That's your story of the burning bush. It's just science. And Thewlis says, that doesn't disprove the existence of God. Like, he just moves right beyond it. And then at the end, I love that when in the director's cut, I really feel that Balian has been taken on a journey of self-actualizing recognition of faith. And my favorite example of that is when Imad, played by, who is it, Alexander Siddig, the sort of second in command in the Muslim army, he says to him at the end, if God did not love you, how could you have done all of this? And he's talking about basically successfully getting peace. So I think it's kind of a beautiful story when told that way, and it's not cynical at the end.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I think that that was the best line in the movie. And I think that there were a great many good lines in the movie. I think it was really well written. And yeah, that one struck me as well. I think that you are right. The cynicism was there initially, but it was also just his own self-hatred for the mistakes in his past that he couldn't let go of, you know. And of course, he had a terrible brother who made things even worse, and the corruption of his brother and the religious figure in his small town did not set him off on a good path. And of course, obviously, he would have never known who his father was. He basically had a pretty bleak and rough life, except for his beautiful wife and the child that he thought was on the way. So I can't imagine watching the movie without understanding that beginning part, because that is why he is why he believes that God has rejected him and continues to reject him. He maintained that belief throughout the film. And that point there at the end with Imad's comment, that was what hammered it home. That was like the closing of that loop. And then he shows mercy to his greatest antagonist, that what was his name again?
Right. Yeah. Oh, so by the way, that scene is not in the theatrical version.
How could you know that
the
scene
ending is, the ending mercy between him and the ending fight and the mercy is not in the theatrical edition of the movie. Absurd.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, it's
it really is incredible that they would leave all those things out, because those are key moments in the character arc of the protagonist.
Yeah.
Thinking that you can just lose those and still pull the story off makes no sense to me. But yes, beautiful moment. There were many. The first one like that, I think, was with David Thewlis when he first, actually, there was one before that even, when before they went into the sea, one of the guys told him, if God has a purpose for you, he'll keep you safe in his hands. And if he doesn't, then God bless you. Like, you're not going to survive the trip if God doesn't have a purpose for you. Right. But hopefully, despite the fact that he doesn't need you, he will still like bless you and see to your soul in the afterlife, basically. That was a pretty, that's a pretty stark statement on how brutal life could be back then. And then he sees, you know, David Thewlis's character. He calls him the Hospitaller. Is that what he's called?
The Hospitaller. Yeah. He never has a name in the movie.
Yeah. And so, you know, he's just telling him there, it's not that you can't talk to God. What God wants of you is to go out there and do his will and be a good man all the time for the rest of this time. So it really had a great way of delivering those very salient, important concepts in a way that didn't disrupt the flow. It wasn't expository. It wasn't hokey. There were some hokey moments, but those weren't them. And I thought that was just really well handled.
Yeah, on that point, he's not in it a whole lot. I mean, you think he's out of the movie within 45 minutes, or certainly within an hour. Liam Neeson plays Godfrey de Ibelin, Godfrey of Ibelin. And I think in limited screen time, he makes such a mark on the story, because he, besides being the father there, I love that he is presented as the... he's basically presented as the ideal, not just Christian, but ideal man, not because he's perfect. I mean, early on, that when they get in that ambush, I had remarked to Chris before the show, they sort of trick you a bit in this movie because you've kind of got the Avengers. You've got Liam Neeson here. You've got the cleric. You've got, if you were playing Dungeons and Dragons, you'd be like, I got my barbarian. I got my cleric. I got my German. I got my African. Like, this is going to be the squad that we're going to go on the Crusades with. And those guys get wiped out right away. But I think it was effective because they set it up and they tell you that while Godfrey de Ibelin is a man of God, he is not a good man through and through. He has killed people. He basically shows Balian right off the bat, like, you're going to compromise in this world. You're in a war. You're going to come up with against people who are going to lie to you, and you're going to have to kill those people, and you're going to have to kill them before they kill you. But as long as you are, as you just said, trying to do the right thing at the right time for the right people, you are behaving in accordance with God's will, even if you have no idea what God's will is. And he, to drive this point home, I had written down the oath that he basically gives to Balian, or has Balian swear, on his own deathbed. And I had written down that basically I'd written down that these are the first principles we talk about. He said, be without fear in the face of your enemy. Speak the truth always, even if it leads to your death. Safeguard the helpless and do no wrong. And then I loved that his dying words was when the cleric says to him, have you confessed or are you sorry for your sins? And he said, all but one. And even that, you know, it's a little hokey. It's like, oh, this is my son. I'm not sorry for him. But I feel that you really feel it. Like, he means that. He's saying, if I go to God in the afterlife and I have to face him, and God says that what I abandoned my son and I created this boy out of wedlock and he's a bastard and that's a sin of mine, I cannot look at this boy and feel that. And again, I think you feel it. It's a humanist story that has faith threaded throughout it.
Indeed. Let's take a quick break here for a word from Loaded Gun Coffee. Guys, wake up to the bold flavors of Loaded Gun Coffee, where passion, precision, and patriotism infuse every sip. As a veteran-owned business, we ensure each cup is steeped in pride and unwavering commitment. Our roasters handpick the finest coffee beans from around the world and have mastered unique brewing methods. Our skilled farmers cultivate the coffee to embody the essence of duty and honor in every meticulously crafted blend. But it's more than just coffee. It's a family enduring commitment to freedom. With military veterans tracing their legacy back to the Civil War, including Purple Heart recipients, Loaded Gun Coffee is a brewed testament of pride and honor. Dedicated to preserving the integrity and strength of our beloved nation, we proudly stand as fierce advocates for a secure border and a strong America, and we stay loaded. Stay loaded, Badlanders, with Loaded Gun Coffee. Visit badlandsmedia.tv/loaded and enter promo code Badlands for 10% off your purchase. That's badlandsmedia.tv/loaded, promo code Badlands. So if you have something you want to start with, go ahead. Otherwise,
you go. I've filibustered. So
okay. So I think that what you were just talking about also falls into line with something that I think translates directly to what we're all kind of dealing with and waking up to now in our society. And we're talking about what Balian's duties are. We know at the end of the film, he and a woman who was queen of multiple places end up right back in his small town at their little house, trying to start a family. He is approached there by a man who says he's the King of England. And I assume that he is legitimately the character, the King of England in this film. And he
Richard the Lionheart.
Yes, exactly. Perfect. Yes, I remember reading that. So he tells him that he's just the blacksmith. He is not Balian. He is not this leader that people have heard about. He is just the blacksmith. He's going to go back and have this small life. Now, what are his priorities here? What are his duties here? Because that is a question on a much like about life philosophy that applies on a much bigger scale. Do you have a duty to the society? Can it be argued that he should be joining Richard the Lionheart's crusade to take back Jerusalem? Is that the best thing for the world? And is it his responsibility to do what's best for other people as defined by other people? Or is it his duty for himself, for this woman that he loves, despite her deranged sociopathy? And is he fulfilling the will of God by going and having this small life and trying to raise a family rather than getting himself involved in war and politics?
Right. It's an open question. But I think I sort of see his ending, his sort of twin endings, the ending with Saladin that we can talk about in a bit, but that sort of coda at the end. I liked it because we talk about sovereignty all the time. We talk about first principles. The way I sort of have framed this in my writing is the idea of radiation, you know, radiating. If each man's a castle and each man radiates outward, his first principles, first of all, it's all you can control in a predictable manner. But if everybody did that, then you would have the world that we should have, basically. And I sort of like that. I feel like this is the rare epic, heroic, quote unquote, epic, where that is the defining principle on display here. I would maybe argue when we eventually do Lord of the Rings that Aragorn is a similar character to this, ultimately sort of an altruistic warrior king who is fighting for peace. But I think that the right to self-determine at the end, which is what Balian is clearly displaying when Richard the Lionheart comes up to him, is, I think, earned through his intentions throughout the movie. One of the notes I'd written down, which is again a reference to the character Imad, his sort of loop that you called it with Imad in this movie, is that Imad says, "Your quality will be known by your enemies." When Balian comes upon Imad and his supposed servant, I mean, Imad is supposedly the servant of the Sultan that Balian kills, But Baelian has literally nothing to gain and actually plenty to lose in terms of survival chances by displaying the morality and honor that he does in that situation, but by radiating that first principle into another node who also radiates first principles back, he is not only spared, but in sparing Baelian, it's this constant feedback loop throughout the movie where it's not just about Baelian. It's that in sparing Baelian, when he is given the chance to kill him, Imad actually presents Saladin unknowingly with the pathway to get peace, which is could only have come through Baelian's defense of Jerusalem. So again, I sort of think that coda at the end, I take it as he's earned self-determination. He self-determined his way through the Crusades, through this latest in a long line of wars, and there's nothing more he could have done, basically. I mean, what more could you do than basically negotiate a ceasefire over Jerusalem? So I do like the ending.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, I don't take it as much about self-determination per se. I think that obviously we have a redemption arc here, and the redemption arc has been completed. And part of the completion of that redemption arc is him understanding that he has the ability to return to that seat of power. And he is with an extremely ambitious woman who may want to return to the seat of power as well. And he has understood that going to war is not going to war in defense of God. It's going to war in defense of wealth and property, or
right
to possess a certain piece of land that all sorts of different people have claims to. It's not by right anyone's, I guess you could say, or at least that's certainly the perspective of the movie. It's the perspective of Baelian clearly as well. As far as I'm concerned, it could not then be God's will based on what he has learned in the context of this film, to then go seek that power again and cause death in order to achieve it. And it doesn't matter on whose behalf that would happen. This is something I think about a lot in terms of what we see as a kind of structural decentralization of everything right now. Would we be in a better world if everyone was making that decision to abandon the pursuit of wealth and power on a broader scale and focus solely on the family and then beyond that, the community, and never really going a whole lot beyond that? You know,
right.
The way we imagine that and idealize that form or that system is through a representative government where we choose our representative who goes off and represents our needs sometimes because we have the understanding that we exist in a larger society and we need to keep the focus as local as possible while sending that representative away to represent our interests. We're not in that at all anymore. And you know, Michael Flynn is a major proponent of that sort of philosophy, General Flynn, talking about local action having a national impact. He reiterated that in a Charlie Kirk interview today. And I think that this is the micro model of what he's talking about. It actually is the highest moral good to make sure that you have that smallest unit well taken care of, and then you work beyond that. And if you can go beyond that, okay, but let's make sure that small unit is taken care of. And what we have, of course, like everything else, is the total inversion of that. That thing is right. Flipped on its head. We are told that everybody's action must at all times be done for a higher social and public good on behalf of the state. And so what we have then is people seeking power on this much larger scale, thinking that they are going to go out there and change the world and make the world a better place when they can't even make their own home life a good place. And I'm not trying to sound judgmental in that. I lived certainly the first half or more of my adult life in that mindset, indoctrinated with that understanding that what we have to do is achieve a certain amount of success and status, wealth and power before we are able to have a family, because all the family needs need to be taken care of in advance, and you have to predict them for 20 years in advance, because you got to be sure you're going to be able to pay for this kid's college right now, not in 20 years, but right now. Yeah. You know, we're indoctrinated into the complete inversion of all of this stuff. And maybe we are seeing right there at the end, the true purpose being modeled.
Right. I like when you talk about sort of controlling, you know, rating those principles, first taking care of your family, yourself, your family, then your community. I think it's a little bit of a corny section. And I think it's the section that gets the liberal critics all upset, the white savior kind of tropes. But I think it effectively communicates what you're talking about, is the section in the movie where Balian is taking control of Ibalin, the land that his father was the baron of, basically. Mm-hmm. And he brings them irrigation. He brings mm-hmm. them these European, which did happen, not obviously in this specific case, but just in general. He basically radiates that this is my land. He doesn't go mm-hmm. there to make peace between Muslims and Christians or to save the people of Jerusalem. He goes there to figure out what he's supposed to be doing. And then when he finds that he's got this land that he inherited from his father, and that there are people on that land, there are women, there are children, there are families, he puts his full effort into making that land, that thing that is his, as bountiful as he can make it. And it's not until he has basically done that he sort of looks for the next good thing he can do. And it just so happens that takes him into this war for Jerusalem. But even that, in the scene, one of my favorite scenes in the movie between King Baldwin and Saladin, where we're really introduced to Saladin for the first time in a significant manner, even in that scene, it's kind of funny because Balian's story could have just ended right there. And he's not going out there to defend Ibalin in this mighty crusade where he has this macro goal of solving a giant intercontinental conflict and religious war. He literally is just going out there to be like, well, all I can do right here, because I'm a good fighter and I've got a bunch of good fighters with me, is I can stall this army, and the women and children will be able to hopefully survive long enough for King Baldwin to come and go to war with them. And that's what he goes out. And it's sort of like, again, throughout the movie, basically fate, God, first principles are constantly saving Balian's ass, because it is the reason he survives that battle is because he has done it for the right reasons. You know, it's sort of an easy theme, but it's also a true one throughout the movie. And then again, I like that scene, we played it before the show, where Saladin and King Baldwin meet in the field, and basically says, you know, King Baldwin says, the men who have been massacring your people are going to be punished. Let's turn around. We're all going to die here. Do we have terms? And it really just reminds me of our theories in this community of sovereign alliances. And overall, I would sum it up as a war for peace. And I really feel that despite claims in many Hollywood movies and epics that the people are fighting for peace, it's never really communicated in the story that way. It's usually, here's the good guys, here's the bad guy. If you beat the bad guys, you then get peace. This is really the first big movie like this that I feel like you can see that these kings are genuinely fighting so that they can stop fighting, and that so everybody can stop dying.
Well, yeah, and that is part of why there was such an effort made to start a war in a contrived sense in the first place. They went and massacred everyone in Saladin's sister's village. So that's a good way to start a war. And then the emissary that was sent to figure out terms and what would be done was killed in front of everybody, defenseless. So they had to work on behalf of the Templars to start this next phase of the war, to provoke this next phase of the war, because they wanted to take over everything. And it didn't work. It didn't work at all. And embarrassingly bad. I mean, Reynaud de Châtillon had an unceremonious end to his life. His throat was slit, and they basically just exposed his open throat so that the blood could pour out of him. And right. then Guy was embarrassed and shamed in front of everyone he's ever known, essentially, after all his men were killed. Yeah. So, gosh, man, you have the third party in there making sure that a war starts no matter what, because they're going to amass more power, more wealth, more control based on starting the war. It's disgusting, but it's also exactly what we see now. And I'm not a great historian of this period, but I believe that the Templars were not generally known as good guys and represented one of those kind of dominating warlike secret societies, elite societies, who believe it is their role to control absolutely everything. I mean, weren't they the kind of the security squad of the merchant bankers back then? Someone in the chat will check and tell me. That element was just right on the nose.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that during the movie. And again, we often talk about whether or not we know our histories as they've been told to us, whether or not those histories are accurate. The Templars is certainly one of those things where I do not know if those are, if the way this movie portrays them is accurate or not. But I can still kind of jive with what it's doing. If you just, you see them as a select party that's in this conflict, you can apply it to the modern day where you've got different groups on the game board, and you've got what we believe are figures or powers, such as the true United States. You often call it the good twin, evil twin sort of dynamic, where you've got Donald Trump and patriots in the West, but then you've also got Joe Biden and the deep state establishment. You've got Netanyahu, whichever side you want to put him on, and then you've got people opposed to him. You've got Mohammed bin Salman. You've got all these leaders. And yes, I booted a dude from the chat because go fuck yourself. I don't really care. A couple people are mad about censorship. But anyway, the reason that I think the Saladin King Baldwin dynamic hits home in this movie is because these are kings or groups, factions that are trying to genuinely assert first principles and multipolarity. Multipolarity is a concept that we see constantly being talked about in recent months and years on the world stage, specifically Xi Jinping, Mohammed bin Salman, Vladimir Putin, constantly talk about multipolarity. And that's what we see developing in this movie, where the Muslims are not saying, the Muslims under Saladin is not saying, you need to convert to us. And the Christians under people like Godfrey and Balian and King Baldwin are not saying the opposite. They're just saying, hey, if we are mutually just asserting first principles, a first principle is basically peace, light and happiness, and mutually assured well-being. War does not benefit either party here. So multipolarity is not a paradigm in which you need to have the same values or to be friends in any way. You just need to both recognize that war is bad for both of your peoples and both of your kingdoms. And just like in this movie where we've got the Templars, you have it in the modern day with intel agencies, you have asymmetric groups funded by globalists who are there to destabilize. They're not trying to get one side to win over the other side. They're not trying to get Israel to defeat Iran. They're not trying to get Iran to defeat Israel. All they're trying to do is get one to attack the other in an actual kinetic manner so that the other will attack the other back. And usually when we trace those roots back far enough or those strings back far enough, we find that it's almost never a people or a nation state that is committing some sort of act. It is a group within a nation state ostensibly representing them, which is exactly what the Templars do in this movie. And again, one of the understated roles in this movie that I really love, that is again butchered in the theatrical version, is Jeremy Irons, because he's not even a king in this movie, but he's this honor-bound Christian knight crusader who is there to, again, radiate those first principles. He doesn't want to escalate anything because they've got stability for the first time in what's implied to be quite a long time. And then all you need is the Gi, and you need Brendan Gleeson's character, the Templars come in. All they need to do is stir some stuff up. And if you had weaker leaders and not Saladin and Baldwin on the board, you would have had a war like they wanted and basically almost got.
Yeah, I mean, you might have even had permanent war because, as we can see, the next wave is coming down from England, somebody else wanting to make sure that they are the ones in control of Jerusalem. And at the time, you know, most of history, there have always been groups that want to control everything. Empires that, and we're dealing with the fall of a global empire right now. In fact, yeah. I was going through this article today on my show. I was talking about the unipartisan compromise that they are still trying to pass, these funding bills for our fake foreign proxy wars. This is the same package, by the way. They've split it up. They're going to bring it back together with border security. This is the same unipartisan compromise package that they have been pitching for 6 months. But now they have the TikTok ban added in, and they have the $300 billion of seized Russian assets that they want to redistribute to whatever companies are involved in what they will call rebuilding Ukraine, which is basically just build back better in Ukraine. This is how they profit. They destabilize and destroy societies and then make people rich off the rebuilding. But this is described directly right here. It used to be a conspiracy theory for us to talk about a world order. And the truth is they have absolutely no problem in describing the world order on their own. It says right here in the battle between a democratic world order represented by Ukraine and authoritarian dictatorship represented by Putin's Russia, the choice should be clear. Well, the choice is clear. Every area they're fighting over in Ukraine just is actually Russia now. Crimea, yeah. Crimea and the Donbass, this eastern portion of Ukraine, they have all voted in referenda to become part of Russia. They all just participated in the Russian election to re-elect Vladimir Putin as president a month ago. And so according to the UN's own standards, the people of a place voting to be independent from that global regime, that makes them independent. They are part of Russia by the UN's own standards. And we are still being told that this world order, you know, that they call like the liberal international one world rules based order, whatever they,
the rules,
whatever term order, they use each time they go through it. We're told that's conspiracy theory. It is quite clear that it is not. That is what they are trying to hold on to right now. And control is being wrested from them by these formerly powerful sovereign nations all around the world, everywhere from China with Hong Kong and Taiwan, Russia with Ukraine. We're going to see what happens with the territory drawn on the map called Israel 75 years ago. Venezuela is taking Guyana back. That's not going to stop. Yeah. I mean, sometimes I wonder if Russia is going to make us give back Alaska, but we shall see. But anyway, that is really what we're dealing with here. Saladin was in Damascus, and we had the rulership, whatever it's represented by, whether it's Balian or the Frenchman or King Baldwin or what, that control over Jerusalem. And there was, if tenuous, still a peace there.
Right. And again, all these parties that you're talking about, whether it's modern day Israel and on down the line, I think it's maybe the most reductive way to look at the controlled opposition dynamic is in U.S. politics when you've got red team versus blue team. I mean, we certainly talk about this more than most. Good thing most Anons, most in the truth community have kind of caught on to that at this point. I think even much of Trump's base needs to wake up to this. They are in increasing numbers understanding that there is such a thing as the uniparty, that this has been a controlled opposition dynamic, red versus blue, my team versus the other team. And I know Christians and Muslims get very angry when you equate them with each other, but you can do it in a way, and I think this film does it in a way that is not saying... one of the things I like the most, I should put it this way, one of the things I like the most about this movie is that when men like Godfrey and the Hospitaller are communicating with other Muslims in this movie, or King Baldwin himself is communicating with a Muslim like Saladin or like the Imad who saves Balian's character and vice versa, I like that they just both refer to God. They connect with each other in their belief over God, right? They understand that they've got all these different rights. And I'm not sitting here trying to preach and say, oh, it's all the same thing, right? I find those arguments to be a little annoying too, and condescending to Christians, condescending to Muslims. But when you are a Christian and you get stuck in this controlled opposition dynamic of going, you know what the problem is? Muslims. And it's like, you know who, yes, there are many Muslims that have been a huge problem in the world over the last century or so, but you know who seeded that stuff and who wanted that stuff to be the way it is, going all the way back to the Crusades on both sides, is these asymmetric players, such as intel agencies, who did things like found ISIS. And if you need any more evidence of that, it should not be representative of all Muslims or all of Arabian lands, look no further than Mohammed bin Salman and the Saudis, who's coming here preaching first principles, talking about multipolarity, talking about men of God, doing a friggin' sword dance with Donald Trump, and go, you know, symbolically, spiritually, pledging to go into war against the forces of evil in the world. If you're stuck in a controlled opposition dynamic of going, those are not the same thing as me, therefore, then, so you're not going to align with somebody like that who says he's a man of God, who's got the same enemies that you've got. And we've got, I think it's one of the major things that, it's the major thing that the powers that be, globalists, whatever you want to call them, the establishment, what they have counted on in human nature is the ease with which we can be put on a team and then said, these are your customs, this is your team, these are people who are different, we're going to make some of these people do actual evil acts, and then we're going to have your people massacre them in a war in the Middle East. So then you create a real version of the controlled opposition dynamic that organically keeps itself going. It's basically a perpetual engine of war, and they start it with bullshit, they seed it with lies and asymmetry, then it carries on its own, which I think is what we see in a lot of the Templars here. You know, they're not necessarily working in this movie on behalf of shadowy cabals and figures, they're men that are self-serving. But why did the Templars start? Why were they sent there in the first place? As you said, who were they originally working for? And same thing goes with ISIS, Al-Qaeda, on down the line.
You mentioned the sword dance, and so I have to remember this as well.
the magical orb.
It's so great.
I love that picture too, because it's such a troll. It does look like an evil conclave of supervillains.
Yeah, no kidding. And just Melania there chilling out.
Yep.
Gosh, man. I mean, I wasn't a Trump supporter when I first saw that, and I was like, what is this? This is the most ridiculous picture I've ever seen. Now it just puts a smile on my face and I love it. Yeah. I wanted to bring up that scene there at the end where Salah ad-Din is walking through Jerusalem and the palaces. And there is the scene where he sees the cross knocked over, fallen on the floor. He picks it up. He sets it on a table. It is obviously a symbol of his respect. But the funny thing is, you know, I am not obviously a practitioner of the Islamic faith, and I don't know a hell of a lot about it. I've read a couple chapters of the Quran. Watching the way that situation was resolved was clearly an illustration of Christian values, and Muslims out there might argue that it is an illustration of Muslim values as well. I am not in a position to speak to that. That is not something that I have come to understand, but I don't have a deep understanding of that. It is interesting that it could be that the respect for Christian values that Salah ad-Din showed in that scene is also exactly what motivated him to come to terms and come to peaceful terms with Balian in the first place. Is it possible that despite the fact he is not a Christian, they were both representing Christian values on that battlefield? Now, are those Islamic values? I don't know. Yeah. They certainly are Christian values. I'm not sure if those values are represented in the same way in other faiths. I have to suspect they are not. The idea that someone is going to put the lives of the innocent and peace as an abstraction above whatever power they might be able to retain, that is an act of deep faith in something, no matter how it, no matter how you come to it. There are a lot of people out there, including a lot of people who call themselves Christians, that would not make that decision. They would make the decision based on some cold calculation that them being in power is what would actually best protect all of those innocent lives. And so they must do whatever possible, no matter how much killing it takes, to remain in power. And we see that argument being made in the real world quite a lot by people who might call themselves Christians, but certainly are not. Namely, and most specifically, all of the neocon warmongers, particularly those who happen to have little R's next to their name, despite the fact that neoconservatism is a product of militant Trotskyite, Trotskyism, and they are militant Trotskyites. That is their lineage.
I wrote a quote on that exact point. I had written a quote down. I believe this was from Godfrey, but I could be wrong. He said, quote, "I've seen too much religion in the eyes of murderers. Holiness is in right action." Or actually, that might have been David Thewlis's character, the hospitaler, but it was one of those two in that sort of group of merry, asymmetric, in a good way, Christians. But that's sort of, and I know it can be, it's not meant to be condescending. You know, when we're talking about the controlled, when I'm talking about the controlled opposition dynamic, when it comes to Christians and Muslims, I'm not trying to sit here and play the opposite game and say they're actually the same thing. And I'm not naive enough to think that. So that's not my point. My point is that whether this movie is historically accurate or not, the story, the templates that it is presenting, the core ideas that it is communicating using these groups, characters, religions as ciphers to communicate is one that I can totally get behind, which is of first principles. You know, when you're talking about, you don't know if Muslims, if modern Muslim Islam promotes the same sort of values as Christianity. No, it probably does not, right? We wouldn't have this kind of, there wouldn't be able to be a weaponized controlled opposition dynamic if that were the case. But I find that on the Christian side of the aisle, something that can frustrate me at times, especially growing up in a family where my dad was raised Protestant, my mom was raised Catholic, I was the rare kid that kind of saw, oh, there's different kinds of Christians, like at a young age. So I was curious and asking about that, right? Because it's Christians and Muslims. Like, well, not really. There's Protestants and there's Catholics and there's Orthodox and there's this and there's that and there's this and there's that. And one of the ideas in Catholicism, and no offense to Catholics out there, but this idea that you need to be forgiven or can be forgiven your sins through a priest who has been ordained by God is such a non-first principle idea and concept that, in my personal view, has no place in Christianity at all. And I would say that many Christians can jive with that. Many Catholics can jive with that and understand that. My mother was a Catholic, but believed that you could pray. You didn't need to be forgiven by a priest. Didn't think that the priest was the proxy that you had to get through God to. Doesn't think you need the church, right? So I'm not saying you have to believe in this stuff. But what I am saying is there's Christians who can accurately draw these lines of demarcation and understand that their own faith in Christianity has been subverted and translated into all these different subsects, but they don't apply the same idea to Islam when we say, okay, what if we traced this all the way back in histories that we do not know? And originally, you've got these groups of people who were agreeing on these core first principles of God and, you know, commandments and all the rest of it. And then over histories and through kings and kingdoms and wars and cults and subversion, we get these sects. Now we have something called modern day Muslims, right? And it's sort of like, even if you are a Christian who thinks that you've got almost nothing in common with that belief system, you could still see how that might not have come up through entirely organic means. It might have originally been coming from the same wellspring. And I like the representation in this movie of somebody like Saladin, whether or not it is accurate, where he is a Muslim, as we are presented in this movie, but really what he is similar to Godfrey, Liam Neeson's character. He's a man of first principles. He believes in radiating first principles. And if you do that, then essentially your actions are indistinguishable from a man of God, whether or not you are a man of God.
That's quite interesting. You mentioned there going through the priest for absolution, and I'm not a Catholic. I don't know how they think of these things. I certainly read the writing of many Catholics. I have family members who are Catholics, so I have some familiarity, but not great familiarity with it. The Vatican had a role in wars for all of time. It has always been a bit strange to me to think about what confession is for a priest who is not operating in good faith, who is not a good or honest man in his humanity. What you are then essentially doing is getting all the secrets of all the people. And if you, again, are not a good man, then you can spend your time mapping out how to manipulate all of those people and acquire more power. And I have no doubt that that sort of thing has been done for centuries and centuries, which isn't to say that all Catholics do that or that's the purpose of confession, but I have no doubt that that sort of thing happens. And what has replaced that in our modern secular age is a proliferation of therapists, where people will go in and they will tell their deepest, darkest secrets to someone of some formal education who will take notes about all these things. And some of them have the ability to write prescriptions and some of them don't, but they're all keeping records on exactly what you have said to them. And at the point where all this stuff is just digitized, well, then it's in the same databases that everything else is in. And all of that history is accessible by people who legitimately are trying to manipulate society and manipulate people into doing that which most benefits that powerful regime on top. We have one more break to get to, unless you would like to respond to that, or we can take a second here and come back to it.
Yeah, let's take a second, and then I got another section here before we get to the end.
Well, all righty then.
Investigating covert CIA operations, investigating the CIA in general, is now off limits to the press, unless you have what Ted Turner called proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which when you're talking about covert operations, you're never going to find as a journalist.
Conspiracy theorists, kooks, crackpots.
You take on the intelligence community, they have six ways from Sunday at getting back at you.
We don't engage in assassinations and kidnappings and things of that kind. As far as I know, we never have.
One third of my staff in this task force was covert action, was propagandist.
Honestly, Twitter or X now is really where I get like all my news.
The unholy alliance between the intelligence community, social media platforms, and legacy media outlets.
And we will have to summon the same capacity to adapt to new circumstances and to meet changing times while upholding timeless ideals.
Fake, disgusting news.
It's one of those pieces of what we've seen around January 6th that is pushed by people that want to suggest that this attack was something other than what it really was.
This is why so many people can't stand the mainstream media and why there's a hardcore animosity towards the media that is pretty much commensurate equivalent to the animosity towards Congress.
Was that your laptop?
For real, I don't know.
You mean the laptop is now another Russia hoax?
This is where
he's going. The laptop is Russia, yes. Russia,
gentlemen,
Russia.
I want to stay on the issue of race.
We have an army of digital soldiers. This was irregular warfare at its finest.
Fuck you. War.
Good stuff. Gets the jimmies rustling in the right ways.
All right. So, what do you got?
Shout out to the viewers. We asked people to hit the thumbs up button, and in the last few weeks, you've been doing it. It helps the show. It's getting more people to Story Hour. So, if you hit the thumbs up, it helps us quite a bit. Well, before we get out of here,
we mentioned this Saturday night during DPH, but John. Apparently, we are the 7th most viewed channel on Rumble for Q1 of 2024. That is quite impressive. So thank you to everybody in the audience who watches and supports Badlands. I mean, that is just awesome. We finished ahead of some pretty big channels, so thank you.
It's awesome. And obviously that's you guys. That's literally you guys. It's your views. We can't literally have no power over it. But when you do hit the thumb, I think people think like, oh, it's just this thing that gives you a signal that you like the show. Yeah. When you hit the thumbs up, it actually literally gets the show in front of more people who then discover it. So it helps out. I wanted to do a section here. I would be remiss. At the end, we've got obviously Balian's character leads Valiant defense against Saladin. Saladin, whatever the true histories say, in the context of this film, he's presented as a tactical and military genius. And Balian is basically depicted the same way. He's an engineer, he's an architect, he's been presented throughout the movie as a builder, he's somebody with an eye for math, etc., and tactics. And the decisions he makes, this is such a unique siege or battle scene in these kind of epics, where usually it's one army is clashing with the other army, we might get a little bit of tactical play. But in this one, even something that could be a cliche scene, like Balian rushing the parapets and throwing the flags of the Muslim invaders off of the walls, you know that when he's doing that, that is a tactical choice to go there and do that, because he sees his men looking at the flags that are down in the courtyard, and he knows they're getting demoralized, which is why this stuff happened in medieval warfare. So he risks his life to go take them out and be seen publicly throwing those flags back over the wall. He allows the war machines of the Muslims to get close enough so that he can destroy them and help them blockade the wall, right? And when he's doing this, you get this kind of wry grin on Saladin's face. And I love this, especially on rewatches with the director's cut, because in a cliche movie, you'd see that wry grin and you'd say, okay, this is a worthy adversary, right? This is the honorable enemy across the field saying, finally, a worthy opponent. And there's some of that going on here, I think. Saladin is pleasantly surprised that Balian is putting up this kind of a fight, despite the fact that he cannot defeat Saladin's army. But I think there's a lot more going on here. What Saladin is really smiling about is that he realizes in that moment, Balian may have just given him the out of slaughtering everybody in those walls. And he says, if I do not deliver a war, I will have no peace. And throughout the movie, especially at the end, he is negotiating with his squire, basically his second in command, Imad, when Imad is saying, you know, can't you call it off? Can't you allow them to surrender? And Saladin is saying, I cannot, because of what we talk about all the time at Badlands and on these shows, public mandate. Saladin knows that because of the atrocities committed in this specific century by the other side, the Christians in this case, He does not have the mandate of the Muslim world to allow these people off, unless, as we're seeing in the current news cycle, he can somehow save face by saying, we really took it to them, but they fought really, really well, and then they surrendered to us, and we did enough damage, and that's, he is happy that Balian, by fighting so hard, and by not giving up, when Balian comes out and Orlando Bloom delivers that, you know, stoic badass and just says, we're going to fight to the last man. We will burn your army to the ground. We will burn Jerusalem to the ground. Saladin is happy that he is saying this in view of all of his generals, because Balian has given him the ability to present mercy to Balian and the men in the walls. And I thought it was a really unique and somewhat realistic portrayal of how two leaders can be seen fighting or seeming to fight when actually they're both trying to negotiate their peoples into wanting to stop fighting.
That is a very interesting point and perspective. And I wonder how we might be able to incorporate the character of Guy after having lost that battle and been paraded in on the back of a donkey, and what the role there is. Because in terms of saving face, that's something that we're dealing with now. He was not an honorable man, and he did dishonorable things. He was not going to be allowed to save face, nor should he have been. Salah ad-Din just didn't want to sully himself by killing this man, because regardless of the fact that he was a dishonorable man, he still had the stature of his office as king and therefore required a different sort of treatment than other people. So That part was really interesting, but no opportunity there to save face. What we are watching now is, I think, probably a good example of a dynamic that has existed well under the surface for a really long time. And that's that what we perceive to be war and what we are told by the television is war is really just two sides negotiating and trying to use leverage in negotiations. These things are decided well in advance of their actual occurrence. Right. And these warlike activities, these acts of war, are done when the negotiation breaks down and somebody needs to achieve leverage that they are not otherwise able to achieve. Now, to the extent that the intelligence organizations were doing this in the past in covert ways, they would do something kind of under the radar, like beneath the level where the general public would understand it, and they would inflict some damage that would then cause somebody to back down and lose leverage and eventually lose the negotiation, and they would go after civilian targets, or they would use sanctions through control of the currency to be able to attack one's people so that a leader would then have to back down and make concessions, otherwise be seen as the person who is causing the suffering of his people. And we've seen Trump many times attempts to blame him for various forms of suffering of the American people. What we're actually seeing play out in Iran and Israel right now, and we're being told this overtly, is that Israel needs to save face, because after we were told about this massive attack that either was thwarted or just never really materialized, we were told that Israel now had justification to glass Iran the same way that they were justified to glass Palestine for 6 months, or Gaza, or whatever we're going to call that area. The justification has evaporated. People got really, really mad because now they have this new justification. Now it's time to go to war with Iran. Let's bomb the shit out of them. That's something that we've been told must happen for at least 15 years, but truthfully longer. John McCain, bomb, 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 bomb Iran. You know, we've seen the lead up to this for a very long time. They finally thought that they were going to do this. We've been told now that Israel has been attacked from Iranian territory. What are we going to do to strike back? Truth is, they're going to do nothing. But they have to be able to do something because they have to save face. And that's where we are right now.
Right. Yeah. And go ahead.
Sorry. The people who are not saving face, who are trying to save face, it's not Israel. It's the global regime, NATO, the United Nations. They have all failed across the board, failed in Ukraine, failed in Israel, will absolutely fail in Taiwan. They are the ones attempting to save face, and it's not working. And you have to wonder if maybe Bibi Netanyahu is not playing along there, and that is why they are committed to the color revolutions. That's why they're committed to pinning the paragliding go-kart incident on Bibi and not anything else.
Yeah, leverage goes both ways. Control goes both ways. Very well said. He is the lesser of the BBs, as we know. That sets up kind of my last point on this movie, which is that the saving face and everything we're seeing in the current war of stories is, to me, the white pill of looking at that is it is seeding the idea of face saving and all that kind of stuff into the collective mind, that it doesn't have to be actualized. It can be a story. And then the last couple lines I love in this movie, again, come from Saladin. One of them is in that final exchange. He says, Balian says, basically, why would I trust you? The Christians massacred the Muslims last time. We've done this back and forth for centuries. And Saladin, throughout the movie, his name is pronounced by most characters Saladin. It's the quick way to pronounce the name. He changes the pronunciation, which I had seen in one of my deep dives on this film. He uses the original pronunciation. He says, I am not those men. I am Salahuddin, which translates literally to righteousness of faith. So he's answering Balian with his name. He's saying, I am not those men. I am righteous of faith. I am a man of God. So I will not do this thing, which is beautiful, I think. And then many people love the line at the end. What is Jerusalem worth? He says, nothing, everything. And to me, what he's saying there is the story of Jerusalem is worth everything to my people. So this is why we have to do this dance. There's a lot to this one. So I'm
we glad got
I checked it out.
We got just a couple minutes left. I don't know if you have the Rumble rants pulled up.
I do.
But also, I think that it was, one of the other critical scenes in this film that we have not touched on yet is when King Baldwin asks him to take over. He is saying, I am giving you all of this power. All you have to do is act the way I acted, but you need to marry my sister, which he would probably maybe be up for. And you're going to have to kill Gidi Lusignan. He basically just denied the king's request and told him that he is fully responsible for looking after the condition of his moral soul. There is no request or command from a king that is going to shift the responsibility onto anyone other than Balian to look after the status of his own eternal soul. And I think that is just such an important lesson, especially in this day and age. You know, we get raised hearing about how the Nazis were all just, we were just following orders. We were just following orders, the Nuremberg trials and all of that. And everybody believes that they would not be that person, that they would stand up and not do the bad thing and then blame it on the fact that they were just following orders. And what we saw throughout COVID is that that's not true. And that a great many of our fellow Americans absolutely will fold at the first sign of inconvenience. And supporting that evil, they can justify based on it not being them personally who was enacting it, despite the fact that they will willingly go along with it, do what they're told, and through all of those actions, prop up the evil of the system itself.
Well said. I think it's in that sequence. I believe it's King Baldwin says, when you stand before God, you cannot say, I was commanded by others. Mm-hmm. That might not have been him, but I think it was him. Either way, it's a quote in the movie. Another great banger to end on before I get to grab these rants is Balian says, we fight over an offense we did not give to those who were not alive to be offended.
That is surprisingly unwoke, by the way, because that is the argument against reparations. Yes, and I was like, damn, how did that appear in a Hollywood film? Did they say this by accident? And sometimes I wonder if they just have no idea what they're saying. The truth is, often they don't. Seriously.
Well,
they have ideas about moral principles. And when they are writing these things, they're experiencing that inversion. So they will miss, like they will say the right thing out of the wrong mouth for the wrong reason. And they will backfire on the point they were attempting to make. It is nuts. And I think that Alex Garland's Civil War is all that. And we will certainly talk more about that in the future.
All right, guys. Well, if this was your first time checking out Kingdom of Heaven, hope you enjoyed it. Check out the director's cut if you have not. We got a few things here. Boosts, J.K. Moore, 777, sent over $17 and said, Chris, surely you've read Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. Thoughts, or have you covered it and I missed it?
I have actually not read that. One of my friends from Hollywood, who is an old school truther, has given that to me to read, and I really need to do that. I will prioritize that. I'm promising you on TV, on the internet right now, that I will prioritize that.
Rants, we got $20 from MZ Nasara 55, who just said thank you, and thank you for the support. P Dwyer 42 sent 20 over and said thanks, so thank you as well. Capra Jean has been supporting a lot of us, sent $25 over, said, late to the party, gentlemen. I watched the director's cut, Kingdom of Heaven, on Monday night, thanks to BB's recommendation on Saturday. Excellent. A whole other perspective. See you in Dallas, Chris.
All right.
And he sent another one over and said, Chris asked me about a Catholic confession joke at GART 4. I think you'll enjoy it. Gave up the magic show of Catholicism back in high school. And by the way, guys, I saw Marmy in the chat getting upset about the confession thing. My point was to say that some people... there are different sects in all of these religions, again. So there's a lot of infighting. I'm not condemning any specific thing. John Henry Bonzo sent $10 over, said, body, blood, soul, and divinity, the bread of life, discourse is biblical. Live Jesus, always information, be well, and press on. Thank you. And Mary G. Rumbles, $10. Great job, guys. Thank you very much. And then the real JJ14 said, imagine how brutal organized religion once had to be to get people to believe without question that the path of God is through kneeling before and being fed crackers by pedophiles. crazy times. Things got a little weird at certain points, but that is it. Thank you guys very much for watching and thumbing.
Okay, so movie for next week. Here is the homework. I am going to go with a film called Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. I have not seen this film before. I hear it's good. I hear it's very interesting. It's kind of another one of those movies about someone who is out there in public, but also happens to be an intelligence asset. The description on IMDb, I'll just share this really quickly before we get out of here. And by the way, guys, Eye of the Storm is up next, so go ahead and stay tuned and check that out. But an adaptation of the cult memoir of a game show impresario named Chuck Barris, in which he purports to have been a CIA hitman. And I'm sure that it is he is just purporting to be that. So, hey, we're going to take a shot with this one. I don't know if it's going to be nothing but net, but sometimes we are pleasantly surprised. So with that, thank you all very much for watching, and we will see you next week for Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
Thank you so much for joining us, and don't forget to hit the thumbs up on this video. And a special thank you to all of our advertising partners. Please remember to shift your dollars to support those businesses that support Badlands Media.